he becomes aware that he is watching them with pleasure. That something almost extinct, some small gesture towards the future, is ready to welcome the spring. In some spare, desperate way, he's looking forward to Easter, the end of Lenten fasting, the end of penitence. There is a world beyond this black world. There is a world of the possible. A world where Anne can be queen is a world where Cromwell can be Cromwell. He sees it, then he doesn't. The moment is fleeting, but insight cannot be taken back. You cannot return to the moment you were in before. In Lent, there are butchers who will sell you red meat if you know where to go. At Austin Friars, he goes down to talk to his kitchen staff and says to his chief man, "The cardinal is sick. He is dispensed from Lent." His cook takes off his hat. "By the Pope?" "By me." He runs his eye along the row of knives in their racks, the cleavers for splitting bones. He picks one up, looks at its edge, decides it needs sharpening, and says, "Do you think I look like a murderer? In your good opinion?" A silence. After a while, Thurston proffers, "At this moment, Master, I would have to say... No, but suppose I were making my way to Gray's Inn. Can you picture to yourself, carrying a folio of papers and an inkhorn? I do suppose a clerk would be carrying those, so you can't picture it." Thurston takes off his hat again and turns it inside out. He looks at it as if his brains might be inside it, or at least some prompt as to what to say next. "I see how you would look like a lawyer. Not like a murderer, no. But if you will forgive me, Master, you always look like a man who knows how to cut up a carcass." He has the kitchen make beef olives for the Cardinal, stuffed with sage and marjoram, neatly trussed and placed side by side in trays, so that the cooks at Richmond need to do nothing but bake them. "Show me where it says in the Bible, a man shall not eat beef olives in March." He thinks of Lady Anne, her unslaked appetite for a fight, the sad ladies about her. He sends those ladies some flat baskets of small tarts, made of preserved oranges and honey. To Anne herself, he sends a dish of almond cream. It is flavoured with rose water and decorated with the preserved petals of roses and with candied violets. He is above riding across the country, carrying food himself, but not that much above it. It's not so many years since the Frescobaldi kitchen in Florence, or perhaps it is, but his memory is clear, exact. He was clarifying calf's foot jelly, chatting away in his mixture of French, Tuscan and Putney, when someone shouted, "Tommaso, they want you upstairs!" His movements were unhurried, as he nodded to a kitchen child, who brought him a basin of water. He washed his hands, dried them on a linen cloth. He took off his apron and hung it on a peg. For all he knows, it is there still. He saw a young boy, younger than him, on hands and knees, scrubbing the steps. He sang as he worked. "Scaramella va alla guerra, con la lancia e la rotella. La sombero, bora borambetta, la bora borombo." "If you please, Giacomo," he said. To let him pass, the boy moved aside into the curve of the wall. A shift of the light wiped the curiosity from his face, blanking it, fading his past into the past, washing the future clean. "Scaramella is off to war." "But I've been to war," he thought. He had gone upstairs. In his ears the roll and stutter of the song's military drum. He had gone upstairs and never come down again. In a corner of the Frescobaldi counting house, a table was waiting for him. "Scaramella fa la gala," he hummed. He had taken his place, sharpened a quill. His thoughts bubbled and swirled, Tuscan, Putney, Castilian oaths. But when he committed his thoughts to paper, they came out in Latin, and perfectly smooth. Even before he walks in from the kitchens at Austin Friars, the women of the house know that he has been to see Anne. "So," Joanne demands, "tall or short?"
"Neither."
"I heard she was very tall. Sallow, is she not?"
"Yes, sallow."
"They say she is graceful, dances well."
"We did not dance."
Mercy says, "But what do you think, a friend to the gospel?"
He shrugs. "We did not pray." "Alice, his little niece."
"What was she wearing?"
"Ah, I can tell you that." He prices and sources her, hood to hem, foot to fingertip.
For her headdress, Anne affects the French style, the round hood flattering the fine bones of her face. He explains this, and though his tone is cool, mercantile, the women somehow do not appreciate it. "You don't like her, do you?" Alice says. And he says it's not for him to have an opinion, or you either, Alice, he says, hugging her and making her giggle. The child, Joe, says, "Our master is in a good mood." "This squirrel trim," Mercy says. And he says, "Calabrian." Alice says, "Oh, Calabrian," and wrinkles her nose. Joanne remarks, "I must say, Thomas, it seems you got close."
"Are her teeth good?"
Mercy says.
"For God's sake, woman, when she sinks them into me, I'll let you know."
When the Cardinal had heard that the Duke of Norfolk was coming out to Richmond to tear him with his teeth, he had laughed and said, "Marry, Thomas, time to be going." But to go north, the Cardinal needs funding. The problem is put to the King's Council, who fall out and continue the quarrel in his hearing. "After all," Charles Brandon says, "one can't let an archbishop creep away to his enthronement like a servant who's stolen the spoons." "He's done more than steal the spoons," Norfolk says. "He's eaten the dinner that would have fed all England. He's filched the tablecloth, by God, and drunk the cellar dry." The King can be elusive. One day, when he thinks he has an appointment to meet Henry, he gets Master Secretary instead. "Sit down," Gardiner says. "Sit down and listen to me. Contain yourself in patience while I put you straight on a few matters." He watches him ranging to and fro, Stephen the noonday devil. Gardiner is a man with bones loose-jointed, his lines flowing with menace. He has great hairy hands and knuckles which crack when he folds his right fist into his left palm. He takes away the menace conveyed and the message. Pausing in the doorway, he says mildly, "Your cousin sends greetings." Gardiner stares at him. His eyebrows bristle like a dog's hackles. He thinks that Cromwell presumes... "Not the King," he says soothingly. "Not His Majesty. I mean your cousin, Richard Williams." Aghast, Gardiner says, "That old tale." "Oh, come," he says. "It's no disgrace to be a royal bastard. Or so we think in my family."
"In your family? What grasp have they on propriety? I have no interest in this young person, recognize no kinship with him, and I will do nothing for him."
"Truly, you don't need to. He calls himself Richard Cromwell now." As he is going, really going this time, he adds, "Don't let it keep you awake, Stephen. I've been into the matter. You may be related to Richard, but you are not related to me." He smiles. Inside, he's beside himself with rage running with it, as if his blood were thin and full of dilute venom like the uncoloured blood of a snake. As soon as he gets home to Austin Friars, he hugs Ralph Sadler and makes his hair stand up in spikes. "Heaven direct me, boy or hedgehog. Ralph, Richard, I am feeling penitent."
"It is the season," Ralph says. I want, he says, to become perfectly calm. I want to be able to get into the coop without ruffling the chicken's feathers. I want to be less like Uncle Norfolk and more like Marlinspike. He has a long, soothing talk in Welsh with Richard, who laughs at him because old words are fading from his memory, and he's forever sliding through bits of English with a sly Borderlands intonation. He gives his little nieces the pearl and coral bracelets he bought them weeks ago, but forgot to give. He goes down to the kitchen and makes suggestions, all of them cheerful. He calls his household staff together, his clerks. We need to plan it, he says, how the cardinal will be made comfortable on the road north. He wants to go slowly so the people can admire him. He needs to arrive in Peterborough for Holy Week, and from there shift by stages to Southwell, where he will plan his further progress to York. The Archbishop's palace at Southwell has good rooms, but still we may need to get builders in. George Cavendish has told him that the Cardinal has taken to spending time in prayer. There are some monks at Richmond whose company he has sought. They spell out to him the value of thorns in the flesh and salt in the wound, the merits of bread and water, and the sombre delights of self-flagellation. Oh, that settles it, he says annoyed. We have to get him on the road. He'd be better off in Yorkshire. He says to Norfolk, Well, my lord, how shall we do this? Do you want him gone or not? Yes? Then come to the king with me. Norfolk grunts. Messages are sent. A day or so later, they find themselves together in an antechamber. They wait. Norfolk paces. Oh, by St. Jude, the Duke says. Shall we get some fresh air? Or don't you lawyers need it? They stroll in the gardens, or he strolls, the Duke stamps. When do the flowers come out? The Duke says. When I was a boy, we never had flowers. It was Buckingham, you know, who brought in this not-garden sort of stuff. Oh, dear, it was fancy. The Duke of Buckingham, King Gardener, had his head cut off for treason. That was 1521, less than 10 years ago. It seems sad to mention it now, in the presence of the spring, singing from every bush, every bough. A summons is received. As they proceed to their interview, the Duke balks and jibs. His eye rolls and his nostrils distend. His breath comes short. When the Duke lays a hand on his shoulder, he's forced to slow his pace and they scuffle along, he resisting his impulse to pull away, like two war veterans in a beggar's procession. Scaramella va alla guerra. Norfolk's hand is trembling. But it is only when they get into the presence that he fully understands how it rattles the old Duke to be in a room with Henry Tudor. The gilded ebullience makes him shrink inside his clothes. Henry greets them cordially. He says it is a wonderful day, and pretty much a wonderful world. He spins around the room, arms wide, reciting some verses of his own composition. He will talk about anything except the cardinal. Frustrated, Norfolk turns a dusky red and begins to mutter. Dismissed, they are backing out. Henry calls, Oh, Cromwell! He and the Duke exchange glances. By the mass, mutters the Duke. Hand behind his back, he indicates, Begone, my Lord Norfolk. I'll catch up with you later. Henry stands with arms folded, eyes on the ground. He says nothing till he, Cromwell, has come close. £1,000? Henry whispers. It is on the tip of his tongue to say, That will be a start on the 10,000 which, to the best of my knowledge and belief, you have owed the Cardinal of York for a decade now. He doesn't say it, of course. At such moments, Henry expects you to fall to your knees, Duke, Earl, Commoner, light and heavy, old and young. He does it. Scar tissue pulls. Few of us, by our 40s, are not carrying injuries. The King signals you can get up.
he adds, his tone curious. The Duke of Norfolk shows you many marks of friendship and favour. The hand on the shoulder, he means the minute and unexpected vibration of ducal palm against plebeian muscle and bone. The Duke is careful to preserve all distinctions of rank. Henry seems relieved. An unwelcome thought creeps into his head. What if you, Henry Tudor, were to be taken ill and fall at my feet? Am I allowed to pick you up? Or must I send for an earl to do it, or a bishop? Henry walks away. He turns and says in a small voice, Every day I miss the Cardinal of York. There is a pause. He whispers, Take the money with our blessing. Don't tell the Duke. Don't tell anyone. Ask your master to pray for me. Tell him it is the best I can do. The thanks he makes, still from his kneeling situation, is eloquent and extensive. Henry looks at him bleakly and says, Dear God, Master Cromwell, you can talk, can't you? He goes out, face composed, fighting the impulse to smile broadly. Scaramella falagala. Every day I miss the Cardinal of York. Norfolk says, What did he say? Oh, nothing, he says. Just some special hard words he wants me to convey to the Cardinal. The itinerary is drawn up. The Cardinal's effects are put on coastal barges to be taken to Hull and go overland from there. He himself has beaten the barges down to a reasonable rate. He tells Richard, You know, £1,000 isn't much when you have a Cardinal to move. Richard asks, How much of your own money is sunk in this enterprise? Some debts should never be tallied, he says. I know what is owed me, but by God, I know what I owe. To Cavendish, he says, How many servants is he taking? Only 160. Only? He nods. Right. Hendon, Royston, Huntingdon, Peterborough. He has men riding ahead with precise instructions. That last night, Wolsey gives him a package. Inside it is a small and hard object, a seal or ring. Open it when I'm gone. People keep walking in and out of the Cardinal's private chamber, carrying chests and bundles of papers. Cavendish wanders through, holding a silver monstrance. You will come north, the Cardinal says. I'll come to fetch you the minute the King summons you back. He believes and does not believe this will happen. The Cardinal gets to his feet. There is a constraint in the air. He, Cromwell, kneels for a blessing. The Cardinal holds out a hand to be kissed. His turquoise ring is missing. The fact does not evade him. For a moment the Cardinal's hand rests on his shoulder, fingers spread, thumb in the hollow of his collarbone. It is time he was gone. So much has been said between them that it is needless to add a marginal note. It is not for him now to gloss the text of their dealings, nor append a moral. This is not the occasion to embrace. If the Cardinal has no more eloquence to offer, he surely has none. Before he has reached the door of the room, the Cardinal has turned back to the fireplace. He pulls his chair to the blaze and raises a hand to shield his face. But his hand is not between himself and the fire. It is between himself and the closing door. He makes for the courtyard. He falters in a smoky recess where the light has extinguished itself. He leans against the wall. He is crying. He says to himself, Let George Cavendish not come by and see me and write it down and make it into a play. He swears softly, in many languages, at life, at himself for giving way to its demands. Servants walk past saying, Master Cromwell's horse is here for him. Master Cromwell's escort at the gate. He waits till he is in command of himself and exits, dispersing coins. When he gets home, The servants ask him, "Are we to paint out the cardinal's coat of arms?" "No, by God," he says. "On the contrary, repaint it." He stands back for a look. "The chaffs could look more lively. And we need a better scarlet for the hat." He hardly sleeps. He dreams of Liz. He wonders if she would know him. The man he vows that soon he will be. Adamant, mild, a keeper of the king's peace. Towards dawn, he dozes. He wakes up thinking, "The cardinal just now will be mounting his horse. Why am I not with him?" It is the 5th of April. Joanne meets him on the stairs. Chastely she kisses his cheek. "Why does God test us?" she whispers. He murmurs, "I do not feel we will pass." He says, "Perhaps I should go up to Southall myself." "I'll go for you," Rafe says. He gives him a list. "Have the whole of the Archbishop's palace scrubbed out. My lord will be bringing his own bed. Draft in kitchen staff from the King's Arms. Check the stabling. Get in musicians. Last time I passed through, I noticed some pigsties up against the palace wall. Find out the owner, pay him off, and knock them down. Don't drink in the Crown. The ale is worse than my father's." Richard says, "Sir, it is time to let the cardinal go." This is a tactical retreat, not a rout. They think he's gone, but he's only gone into a back room. He skulks among the files. He hears Richard say, "His heart is leading him." It is an experienced heart. But can a general organize a retreat when he doesn't know where the enemy is? The king is so double in this matter. One could retreat straight into his arms. "Jesus, you think our master is double too?" "Triple at least," Rafe says. "Look, there was no profit for him, ever, in deserting the old man. What would he get but the name of deserter? Perhaps something is to be got by sticking fast, for all of us." "Off you go then, swine boy. Who else would think about the pigsties? Thomas More, for instance, would never think about them. Or he would be exhorting the pig-keeper, my good man. Easter approacheth. Hast thou prepared to receive Holy Communion?" Rafe laughs. "By the way, Richard, hast thou?" Richard says, "I can get a piece of bread any day in the week." During Holy Week, reports come in from Peterborough. More people have crowded in to look at Wolsey than have been in that town in living memory. As the cardinal moves north, he follows him on the map of these islands he keeps in his head. Stamford, Grantham, Newark. The travelling court arrives in Southall on the 28th of April. He, Cromwell, writes to soothe him. He writes to warn him. He is afraid that the Boleyns, or Norfolk, or both, have found some way of implanting a spy in the cardinal's retinue. The ambassador, Chapuis, hurrying away from an audience with the king, has touched his sleeve, drawn him aside.
"Monsieur Cromwell, I thought to call at your house. We are neighbours, you know."
"I should like to welcome you."
"But people inform me you are often with the king now, which is pleasant, is it not? Your old master, I hear from him every week. He has become solicitous about the queen's health. He asks if she is in good spirits and begs her to consider that soon she will be restored to the king's bosom. And bed."
Chapuis smiles. He is enjoying himself.
"The concubine will not help him. We know you have tried with her and failed. So now he turns back to the queen."
He is forced to ask. "And the queen says?"
"She says, I hope God in his mercy finds it possible to forgive the cardinal, for I never can."
Chapuis waits. He does not speak. The ambassador resumes.
I think you are sensible of the tangle of wreckage that will be left if this divorce is granted, or, shall we say, somehow extorted from His Holiness. The Emperor, in defense of his aunt, may make war on England. Your merchant friends will lose their livelihoods, and many will lose their lives. Your Tudor king may go down, and the old nobility come into their own.
Why are you telling me this?
I am telling all Englishmen.
Door to door?
He is meant to pass to the Cardinal this message, that he has come to the end of his credit with the Emperor. What will that do but drive him into an appeal to the French king? Either way, treason lies. He imagines the Cardinal among the canons at Southwell, in his chair in the chapter house, presiding beneath the high vaulting like a prince at his ease in some forest glade, wreathed by carvings of leaves and flowers. They are so supple that it is as if the columns, the ribs, have quickened, as if stone has burst into florid life. The capitals are decked with berries, finials are twisted stems, roses entangle the shafts, flowers and seeds flourish on one stalk. From the foliage, faces peer, the faces of dogs, of hares, of goats. There are human faces, too, so lifelike that perhaps they can change their expression. Perhaps they stare down, astonished, at the portly scarlet form of his patron. And perhaps, in the silence of the night, when the cannons are sleeping, the stone men whistle and sing. In Italy he learned a memory system, and furnished it with pictures. Some are drawn from wood and field, from hedgerow and copse, shy, hiding animals, eyes bright in the undergrowth. Some are foxes and deer. Some are griffins, dragons. Some are men and women, nuns, warriors, doctors of the church. In their hands he puts unlikely objects. St. Ursula, a crossbow. St. Jerome, a scythe. While Plato bears a soup ladle, and Achilles a dozen damsons in a wooden bowl. It is no use hoping to remember with the help of common objects familiar faces. One needs startling juxtapositions, images that are more or less peculiar, ridiculous, even indecent. When you have made the images, you place them about the world in locations you choose, each one with its parcel of words, of figures, which they will yield you on demand. At Greenwich, a shaven cat may peep at you from behind a cupboard. At the Palace of Westminster, a snake may leer down from a beam and hiss your name. Some of these images are flat, and you can walk on them. Some are clothed in skin and walk around in a room. But perhaps they are men with their heads on backwards, or with tufted tails like the leopards in coats of arms. Some scowl at you like Norfolk, or gawp at you like my Lord Suffolk, with bewilderment. Some speak, some quack. He keeps them in strict order in the gallery of his mind's eye. Perhaps it is because he is used to making these images that his head is peopled with the cast of 1,000 plays, 10,000 interludes. It is because of this practice that he tends to glimpse his dead wife lurking in a stairwell, her white face upturned, or whisking around a corner of the Austin Friars, or the house at Stepney. Now the image is beginning to merge with that of her sister Joanne, and everything that belonged to Liz is beginning to belong to her, her half-smile, her questioning glance, her way of being naked. Till he says, enough, and scrubs her out of his mind. Rafe rides up the country with messages to Wolsey, too secret to put into letters. He would go himself, but though Parliament is prorogued, he cannot get away, because he is afraid of what might be said about Wolsey if he is not there to defend him. And at short notice the King might want him, or Lady Anne. And although I am not with you in person, he writes, yet be assured I am, and during my life shall be, with your grace in heart, spirit, prayer, and service. The Cardinal replies, he is
mine own good, trusty, and most assured refuge in this my calamity. He is mine own entirely beloved Cromwell. He writes to ask for quails. He writes to ask for flower seeds.
Seeds?
Joanne says. He is planning to take root.